Today is October 15th, 1996. I am in the WHA studios with Martha Peterson, and we're going to be talking about her career here at the UW, which is part of a very interesting career in higher education. Let's start off first by just talking a little bit about your background, where you were born, where you went to school, any early teachers or influences in your family, people who influenced you in your family toward college and toward a career.
Well, I was born in 1916 in Jamestown, Kansas, on my grandfather's homestead. My mother and my father were, my father was farming and my mother was taking care of my grandfather. And I grew up there until I was 12 years old, went to the country school or the town school at Jamestown, and was not much, school was not much of use to me in the grades. My grandfather taught me to read and write and do arithmetic when I was about 3 years old. I thought it was always that he didn't want me bothering him when he wanted to read. So he taught me to read, and then I could read, and he keep still, and he could read. Or if I didn't, I didn't respond to that, he gave me numbers to add and subtract and multiply. So I sat by his chair doing all this kind of thing while he did what he wanted to do. And my family, my mother and father, did not have education beyond the eighth grade. My mother always resented that because her brother got to go to law school, and she didn't. The choice of the people in the family was they could either have a farm or go to school. That was the boys. The girls had no choice. They got the farm. So my mother got the homestead, and that's where I grew up. Mm. And then when I was about 12, my mother and father divorced, and I went to Salina High School, starting my freshman year, and that's where my education really began. Up until then, I sort of freewheeled it. I learned what I wanted to learn, and if I didn't want to learn it, I didn't bother, and I went home and grandfather taught me the rest of it. But in Salina, I learned the rules you lived by, and that when you learned Latin and mathematics and all that sort of thing, you did your homework every night and you came prepared to answer questions. So my first real education was Salina High School, and they had excellent teachers, and we all did remarkably well.
Now, you got interested in math early on. How did that come about?
Oh, I'm not sure. My dad was very good at adding and subtracting, and of course I was taught to add and subtract and multiply. I knew my multiplication tables by the time I went to school. So that was very normal for me. I wasn't afraid of numbers. I liked numbers. And then when I got to Salina, my dad had taught me to handle fractions. He learned when I was in about the seventh grade that I didn't know how to handle fractions. And he said that if you were dumb, I'd excuse you. But you are going to learn how to handle fractions. So every night after dinner, we did fractions. Multiply, divide, subtract. When I got to Salina, I was the only one in the algebra class who could handle all of this, and it made no difference to me whether it was numbers or A, B, C, D. I could handle fractions, and I was the best in the class in algebra. We took tests in Salina from Emporia, and after our grades came in, then they selected the two top ones to go to state tests representing the school. I didn't go in algebra, but the next year in geometry, I was selected to represent Salina High School with another student in the state tests. And I was the best in geometry in the state. And so, you know, it just seemed natural. I was good at mathematics, and so I did it.
Mm. And then you went on to college and majored in math, correct?
Yes, I went to the University of Kansas. I wasn't sure that I wanted to major in mathematics. In fact, in my sophomore year, I toyed around a bit with majoring in sociology because I wanted to do good in the world. And after one course in that, I decided it was a bunch of hogwash that I couldn't be bothered with that. And so I went back to mathematics and declared my major in my junior year. One fact there that I often think about, when I declared my major, I decided that I ought to know something more about physics. I'd had physics and chemistry in high school, but no other science. So when I declared my major in mathematics, I wanted to enroll in elementary physics. And I went over to see the head of the department, because you had to get permission if you were a woman. And he said, "We don't want women in our physics classes." This was 1930, 5. We don't want women in. If you're going into medicine, we'd put you in a special class where we have women medics. But we really don't want you. And my reaction to that was, they don't want me, I don't want them. And so forget about it. Later, I came back to teach mathematics at the University of Kansas, having other physics or mathematics, and I was teaching engineers. So I signed up to audit a course from the same man who had refused to take me in 1935, and I audited the course in physics so I would have some background for teaching engineering. But it's amazing. And that man was a good friend all through my years in the faculty at the university, and I don't know whether he remembered, but it was just the policy of the physics department. No women.
Yes, and you could go into medicine and
yeah, and they do this little special class for you.
And they do a special class. That's interesting. So, then you went to teach at UK and like you said in math. And
yeah.
How did you get into administration at that, or into the dean?
Well, I taught for 5 years in high schools in Kansas and finished my master's degree, and that's when they invited me to come back to teach, and that was the start of World War II. And they needed anyone who could teach mathematics. They were borrowing English professors and history professors and everyone to come over because we had a Navy program and we had a Army program and we had Brooklyn bakers who needed mathematics. And so everyone was teaching mathematics. And I taught, stayed on with that, teaching mathematics full time. Actually was in charge of scheduling the Army and the Navy programs, the teachers for them. That was what I was supposed to do, be sure there was a teacher in the classroom every day that one of these classes met, and taught myself from usually a 7:30 and 8:30 and maybe a 10:30 and a 1:30 and 2:30 during those Army years. And when they were over, I was kept on and started my PhD in mathematics. And the chancellor of the university then was Dean Mallott, who went on later to be president of Cornell, just died at 98 a couple of weeks ago. But he started visiting with me. And he said, you know, we've got a job open in the Dean of Women's office. It's managing sororities. And I said, well, I wasn't a member of a sorority, and I certainly don't want to do that. I like teaching mathematics. But he kept stopping me and saying, you ought to try this. And it'll only be one-third time, and you can still teach two-thirds time, and just try it. So I tried it, and that's the way I got into administration.
And did you enjoy administration?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, by that time, I realized that I wasn't a genius in mathematics. I wasn't going to set the world on fire doing research in mathematics. I really didn't care for that, you know, the esoteric kinds of things you had to deal with, and my mind wasn't that kind of a mind. I could handle it, and I was a good teacher, and most of the students who were in my class would still attest to that, that you know, I was one of the best teachers they ever had in calculus. So I still meet students when I go, former students when I go back to Kansas, and they say, you know, I never would have gotten through calculus but for you. So I knew I was good at that, but I did not want to do the research, that kind of thing. I just knew that I didn't have the mind for it. And when I got into administration, I liked it. So I switched my PhD direction from mathematics to educational counseling and guidance, and got a PhD in that, did some work at Northwestern, and decided that was my field.
And you eventually became dean of women's students at Kansas?
Well, I was...
Or dean of women?
I was assistant dean of women and dean of women at Kansas, and then I came to Wisconsin as dean of women in 1956. And in 62 or 63, I don't know, Fred Harrington asked me to be university dean of students. And that was a little different from anything I'd ever done. I had decided that I had reached, just as I did in mathematics, that I couldn't continue teaching calculus every year for the next 50 years and keep much enthusiasm for it. I decided that I'd gotten to the place being dean of women where I wasn't as excited about some things as I ought to be. You know, we always had these committees that planned orientation. And I suddenly realized I knew how it was going to come out, and why did we have to sit every afternoon for 6 weeks planning orientation when you knew how it was going to come out? And then swing out was another thing we planned. And I'd gotten to the point I'd lost my enthusiasm, and I thought some people younger than I could do it better. So I made the decision that I would return to teaching mathematics, and I would really go ahead and begin to learn about computers and that sort of thing that was coming in that I thought I'd be fascinated with. So I started auditing a course with Mark Ingram, who was very supportive in this idea. He said, if you don't like what you're doing, or if you, I said, I like it, but I just can't see working up my enthusiasm every fall for orientation week. I just can't see doing this, and it's not fair to the students, and it's not fair to me. So I started auditing Mark Ingram's class, and then Fred Harrington got wind of this and asked if I'd be University of Dean of Students. And my job there for the last years, I think from 63 to 67, was to be on the Madison campus 1 week, on the Milwaukee campus 1 week, and on the Center's campus, I'd go 1 week to Wausau and 1 week to Marshfield, and that was my semester's work. And I was supposed to start financial aid programs and scholarship programs and do what I could to build living conditions for the students on campus and do what I could to enforce the place of women on campus. And that was my mission. I was to work with the people there, but to try to help them set up these programs. And at Milwaukee, I worked with the building of the union and setting up the union. I was never the top administrator, but the people they had doing the job, I worked with them in planning the program as the person from Madison who was supposed to have more answers. So I did that until 67, when I left.
Let's go back to your coming to Madison. How did you hear about the job at Madison? What did you know about Madison when you were contacted? And tell me about those early visits. I know E.B. Fred and Ira Baldwin were involved in those. Mm-hmm. Let's put you in Madison. How did that come about?
Well, I was doing very well as Dean of Women at the University of Kansas. Dean Malott, whom I'd admired so much, was had left to go to Cornell. And one of my classmates, one of the men I graduated with in the university, had become become chancellor. He'd been dean of the medical school. And Franklin and I weren't soulmates. In fact, if I were to describe it, we cheerfully hated each other all through undergraduate years. He was a politician who was always trying to manipulate the dormitory where I lived to get the votes for the president of the student body and that sort of thing. And I really didn't know him, but I didn't like him. I thought he was arrogant and manipulative and all that sort of thing as an undergraduate. And then suddenly here he was as chancellor. And I didn't think he'd like me any better than I'd liked him. But we worked together very beautifully and got along just fine. And he recommended me for a Student Personnel Commission of the American Council on Education. And this was 12 people in the early 1950s who were supposed to look at what was happening to students on campus after the return of the veterans and all the changes. And we wrote papers and did studies and went all over the United States in doing that kind of thing. And Franklin had nominated me for that. In the course of the 3 years I served on the commission, Arthur Adams, the chairman of ACE, got to know me and talked with me. Was I going to stay at Kansas being dean of women all my life? And I said, I didn't know. I didn't know. And so one day, Ira Baldwin called me and said there was an opening for a dean of women at the University of Wisconsin, and would I be interested in applying? And I said, well, no, I'm pretty happy here, and I'm finishing my PhD. I have to take my orals in the spring, and now is not any time for me to move until I finish my PhD. But I thought I better go down and tell Franklin Murphy about this. And he said, well, Arthur Adams and I thought you were ready for the job at Wisconsin, and we can work it out so you can come back and finish your PhD. We'll do that. And we know E.B. Fred at Wisconsin will let you do that. So why don't you go for the interview? So I went for the interview, and That happened.
What had you known about Wisconsin before you went there?
I had not known a lot about Wisconsin before I came for the interview. I'd been told by one of my very favorite professors at Northwestern, Shirley Hamron, that it was the most beautiful campus in the United States. And the neighbor across the way from us in Lawrence was Florence Daniels, Florence Daniels Drury. And her father was, I think, chairman of the chemistry department, Farrington Daniels. Anyhow, he came down. He'd been down, and I'd visited with him. And Elmer Beth, who was head of the journalism school, was a professor, was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin, and they'd all talked to me, you know, as you do, about what wonderful years they'd had here. So I held it in high regard. I'd known people that I liked who liked Wisconsin. But that's about all I knew. I knew they drank beer in the Union, and I wasn't sure how that fit with someone who came from Kansas, where we were still totally prohibition, you know. Many of my problems was handling someone who'd spiked the punch in the dormitory and that sort of thing. And here I was considering a campus where they drank beer. The other thing I was fearful about when I came that spring, and I remember asking E.B. Fred about this, was that I had not been all that traditional in growing up in University of Kansas in the 1936. We had a group of students who were, I think, communists, I don't know, but they were my friends, and I often went to their meetings and discussed with them things that were of interest. And one summer when I was in New York at a summer session, we went to communist meetings. And I decided after the third meeting, when we ask a question, oh, all the ideas sounded pretty nice. But when we ask, how are you going to get from where we are now to your system, they said, we're going to have to kill people. And I decided I want no part of that. So, you know, but I'd had that association. And here was Joe McCarthy checking everyone at Harvard and every place else if they'd, and I thought, you know, they could get a list of people who attended some meetings in New York in 1936, and here would be my name on it. And so I said to E.B. Fred, you know, I'm not just a Kansas Republican. One of my best friends was killed in the war in Spain. I have thought about other ideas. And I said, if Mr. McCarthy starts asking, I'll have to say yes. I did all these. He said, Senator McCarthy won't bother anyone at the university. Don't worry about that. So, but that was another thing, a fear I had in coming.
Why do you think E.B. Fred said Senator McCarthy won't bother anyone at the UW?
I don't think he did he?
No, you just said that that E.B. Oh, you don't think McCarthy?
I think McCarthy was very careful that he attacked Harvard and places, but he did not attack the university in any way whatsoever, as far as I know. Oh, he could find fault with something someone said. But as far as the kind of attack he leveled at academicians, professors, and others, he didn't do it at the University of Wisconsin.
Maybe he knew who his voting constituency was.
He knew. I think he knew that this was not a good topic. At least that's the way I always interpreted it. I didn't ask any more questions. But certainly all the years I was here, and Senator McCarthy was senator, we never heard anything about him.
Now, you said that you knew students drank beer here. When you first came to Madison, did you have any other expectations about what the students might be like here? And what happened when you finally actually started meeting the students and dealing in your position as Dean of Women?
Well, when I first came here, I had high opinion for the students. I had met some of them in some of the national meetings I'd gone to, and I had worked with the National Student Association.
Excuse me, could we start that over again, and could you say when I came here and then the year that you came here?
When I came in here in 1956, I brought with me a rather high opinion of the students at the university. I had met some of them on the Student Personnel Committee. I had met some of them in the National Student Association, with which I had worked. And I had thought they were remarkably mature and intelligent and level-headed, so I expected to find a group of students who were perhaps a little more sophisticated than the students at Kansas. When I'd gone to Northwestern, I came home one time and said to one of the deans, you know, I talk to the students at Northwestern, and they've been to operas, and they go to the Chicago Art Institute, and they've read all these books. It's far different from the students we have here at Kansas. And he said, have you talked with them about harvesting wheat, or have you talked with them about William Allen White, or have you... He said the students at Kansas come out of a different background, and from their background are just as sophisticated and bright. But at Northwestern, and then I expected this at Wisconsin, you will find a different level of sophistication and interest. And I did. I was very much pleased with the students when I came here, found that they served on committees in a way they didn't at Kansas, that they were less prone to do what they were told without discussion than the students I'd been accustomed to. They asked questions, but once you had a reasonable explanation of it, they were very cooperative, I thought. And I came with an idea they would be that way, and they were.
You replaced Louise Troxell.
Yes.
And, talk for a moment about her and her, what her expectations were as dean and how she handled discipline problems and things like that, and how you think that you might have, how you compared to her in your own approach.
You've asked, that's not the way to start that. Louise Troxell, who preceded me as dean of women here, was a graduate in mathematics from the University of Kansas. She grew up in Topeka, was one of the Flemings of Topeka, and had gotten her degree in mathematics, and they knew her in the mathematics department at the University of Kansas. And when I told them I was coming here, they remembered Louise Fleming. She was very kind to me. She said, I'm not going to do anything to set your course, nor am I going to tell you about the problems you're going to meet here. I'm just going to say you've got a good staff. You can count on Emily Chervenik. You can count on Helen Kaiser. You can count on the people in this office, Neva Fawning, to do a good job and give you answers that are honest. I'm going to clear out everything. I'm even going to take my rocking chair. I'm going to take it. You can't have my rocking chair. But she said, I'm trying to leave things in good order, and anything that you have to do that builds on what I've done, there will be a file on it. If there's no file on it, it means I meant for you to start on your own. And it was an easy way to start, and she had a fine reputation. She was very much interested in making sure women had an equal opportunity at the University of Wisconsin, and worked hard on that and on the national level for equal opportunity for women. I, at that point, was not aware, as I became later, of some of the barriers to women. Oh, I'd met them as I'd come along, but I just had paid no mind to them. You know, you don't think I can do it? Well, I'll do it if I want to. And I had not worried much about the barriers for women. Louise Troxell was more interested in that and had involved more women in the state in that than had been my custom. So that was a whole new area that I had to take on. But she said, you don't have to promote any of the values that I promoted. It's your job. And if you ever want to ask a question, you can. But she said, I think Neva or Helen or Emily can answer any question that I would answer. So that was the way I came into it.
Did you find that the students at Wisconsin were different from the students at the University of Kansas in terms of the issues they dealt with and the discipline problems
Yes.
that came up with?
Yes. And how?
You have to also say the students,
In comparing the students at the University of Kansas and the University of Wisconsin, the students at the University of Kansas always knew there were these other places where political and social events were taking place that they were not a part of. They had the Kansas students had a sort of inferiority complex. There is a bigger world out there, and you could always sit down and talk with them about the bigger world out there. And they wanted to be a part of it and aware of it, but they didn't want to cut all their roots out from under. They expected to remain Kansans. and we dealt with many interesting students there. I was dean when Clyde LaVellette was playing basketball at Kansas, and I was dean and helped recruit Wilt Chamberlain to Kansas, and handled discipline problems with Wilt Chamberlain, and handled discipline problems with not Nancy Landon Kassebaum, she was a student while I was there, but her brother John Cobb came and spiked the punch at a Christmas party. And so I dealt with students that were fairly sophisticated and in certain ways, but once you talked with them, it was very easy to say, you know, if you're going to grow up and be a part of a world that beyond Kansas, you've got to learn to handle these things and you can't make a fool of yourself. And so it was that. When I came to Wisconsin and met the students here, I found bright students from New York City who had three times the answers I did on things. I found students who'd participated in national organizations, who were leaders, who knew all kinds of people, who'd worked in Washington. And they had a higher degree of sophistication. And you could try to tell them something, but you better be sure you were on firm ground. I think I realized at the University of Kansas what I wasn't good about. I mean, University of Wisconsin, what I wasn't good at doing was trying to tell a student that he or she had to abide by a regulation that I thought was silly. If I believed in what I was doing, and if I believed what they were doing was detrimental to their career, I could handle that. But if I was having to enforce something that I thought was kind of silly to start out with, they saw through me immediately, and they worked their way around me and got me in a box where I really had to stand up to other people on the campus saying, you know, this doesn't make any sense. So that there was a level of intelligence here and questioning I hadn't met at Kansas.
Can you remember any of the names of the students in those early years in the 50s and late 50s at UW that especially impressed you?
Oh, when I first came, the first year I came, I think was the first woman president of the Wisconsin Student Association, Helen Rabine from Oshkosh or Nina Menasha or Appleton. She was most impressive. She went on to work in the National Student Association and eventually married Ray Farabee from Austin, Texas, who had been president of the National Student Association, and they moved to Texas, and Helen became, I think, president of the AAUW, the state of Texas, and was very influential, and always a leader, and so was Ray. Ray was one of the people considered very seriously for candidate for governor of Texas at one time. Helen was impressive as a student, and we kept in touch afterwards. I think of Gar Alperovitz and Barbara Riemann. He was head of the union, and Barbara Riemann, her father was a professor of physics, and he's now a professor at Harvard, and has always shaken the tree a little bit wherever he was in talking about ideas, and he did it here. As head of the union, I think he had Porter Butts in a snit most of the time because he was asking questions Porter didn't want to deal with, but Gar was brilliant. Later years, there was Jeff Greenfield, who was quite as remarkable a person. I met him. He was editor of the Cardinal in his sophomore year. And he was as remarkable young man as I'd ever known. Oralee Stiles from Sheboygan, I remember her, a very able person who did all kinds of good things here at the university. Greg Gallo from Kenosha. Sure, I remember him. Ed Garvey, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's return to the 50s for a moment. Now, you've talked about your job as Dean of Women. There was also a Dean of Men at that mm-hmm. point in time. Who was the Dean of Men, and how did the Dean of Men and the Dean of Women, was this like the farmer and the cowman should be friends, or were they naturally...
You ask about the relationship between the Dean of Women's Office and the Dean of Men's Office. It had not been a totally cooperative relationship when Louise Troxell was here. She did not tell me that, but I inherited some of the aftermath of that. Louise Troxell was not as much a disciplinarian as Ted Zillman. Ted Zillman was very legalistic and very much handled all situations in a legalistic way. I always thought he had an extra soft spot for fraternities, so that if it were a fraternity that got in trouble, they didn't always get handled as severely as some of the other people did on campus. But there was a tension between the two. I would say the Dean of Women's Office tended to look at the student and see what would make most sense in helping that student out of the mess she was in, whether it was a severe kind of thing or whether it wasn't. And yet, as I look back on it, I think this was such a big and thriving place with so many things going on and so many people to control, that to have certain rigid standards and expect people to enforce them or to live by them, as the Dean Zillman did, and being really harsh about it when they didn't obey, may have been a wise course. But at the Dean of Women's Office, maybe because we were dealing with women, we weren't quite that rigid, and we were always conflicting on this. I hadn't been here more than a couple of weeks when some young woman didn't come back to her dormitory one Saturday night. And this was reported to me. And somehow or other, it was reported to the Dean of Students' Office the name of the young man who had kept her out. So we had a student disciplinary meeting on this event of the young woman not returning to her dormitory at night. And on the committee was Professor Conway of the Law School, and Frankie Cumby from the School of Education, Aaron Ide, I think, from chemistry. I was not accustomed to dealing with disciplinary problems with faculty being there. I had no idea. I'd been here 2 weeks, no idea what this was. But in talking to this young woman, who wasn't a Wisconsin student, she had come for the summer and was going back to her own very strict Lutheran school in the fall. She said, you know, it was just late when we got back to the dormitory, and I was afraid to go in. So I went over to where he lived and slept on the divan downstairs all night. And I believed her. I believed this was what had happened. And she came and told the story to the disciplinary committee. Ted Zillman thought it was the kind of thing that we couldn't tolerate at this university. If we, no matter what happened, she'd been out all night, and no matter what happened, we had to apply strict discipline. And here I was, brand new, and I can remember John Conway turning to me and saying, "What would you do?" I said, "Well, I think I would talk seriously with this young woman about what she had done and what kind of a spot she'd put herself in." And I said, "I think that I would say to her, I'm not going to put this on your record. If you feel you need to tell your dean about it when you go back to your college, fine. I'm not going to report it. I think this is what I would do." And I would demand that she had obey university rules the rest of time here, not stay out before or after closing hours. Ted Zillman thought they both should be dropped from the university, and that the young woman's dean should be notified of this heinous crime she had done. And he argued very fiercely, and I decided I really didn't understand the moral code at the University of Wisconsin, so I shut up after a while. But in the long run, the faculty committee supported my position, and the best friends I ever had at the university were Frankie Cumby and Aaron Ide. But this was my first 2 weeks, and there was a difference here. I think Ted and I both wanted the same thing, but his was more legalistic. She'd done this, so she had to pay. And I don't know whatever happened to the young man. I think he was a Wisconsin man, but we didn't deal with him much. We just dealt with the young woman.
I think maybe I read this in your autobiography. I can't exactly remember, but there was a point where you went to Ira Baldwin and you talked about maybe this wasn't your kind of place. Could you explain how that came about?
Well, that came about because in almost every... you asked me why I went to Ira Baldwin and said, I think this is not my spot, and I can move on, and I really don't think I belong here. I did this after about 2 years. I'd become aware that in every student life and interest committee meeting, in every disciplinary committee meeting, and in every meeting that we had, I was usually on the opposite side from Mr. Zillman. And the students knew this. They knew this. And either I had to keep still, or I had to defy or question the procedure. And it wasn't a comfortable position. He'd been here all these years. He had great love for the university. He knew what made the university function in a way I didn't. And it just seemed to me that this was not the place for me. And that's when I went to Ira Baldwin and said, you know, I can very easily find another job, and maybe I should. And he said, no, we knew what we were getting when we got you, and we want you to stay on and do what you're doing. So I did.
Feeling that you had the administration support.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I had no question about it.
One of the real interesting aspects of student life relates to the phrase in loco parentis.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about that phrase for a while. Tell me how you see that term, the application of that term changing from the post-World War II years into the 50s and finally into the 60s, if we could bring it into that.
You asked me about you, well, I shouldn't say that. In loco parentis was a catch-all for university administrations when they wanted to act as parents to students. I did not ever think it was an appropriate term to apply to the relationship of faculty and administration to students. There was no way we could be in loco parentis. We weren't the parents. And I only had to see several parents and raise questions about something their son or daughter had done to realize that I didn't ask the same things of students that they asked. So they had their relationship to the parents, which I thought the university needed to respect. And if the parents wanted certain kinds of things from their sons and daughters, they ought to be able to do it. But there were some of those the university couldn't enforce. And that was between the parent and the child. The university, on the other hand, I saw both administration and faculty as teachers, seeing these young men and young women growing up and faced with decisions that they needed to make. It always seemed to me that you ought to enforce what their parents wanted, in the sense of saying, how would you, always being concerned, what would your father or your mother think of this, and how are you going to justify what you're doing to them? I thought they always had to take that as one factor in making their decision. I thought they had to think of their own well-being in future. If they were doing things that was apt to injure their health or make, you know, get them in a spot where they could not do the things they wanted to do because of some very petty kind of activity they were engaged in, they ought to think about that. They ought to think about their own future. And it was the job of the university always to keep in front of them those things that most likely would lead to their success, but that we really couldn't enforce it as parents did. And in the long run, you had, well, if you tried to enforce something they didn't care to enforce, they found ways around it. I can't tell you the number of students who tell me now, I've met president of corporations, said, when I was at the University of Wisconsin, my girlfriend and I slipped out every night and no one ever knew it. Well, you knew that they could do whatever they wanted to do. What you needed to do was teach and build on a body of knowledge that would help them be the kind of people they wanted to be. So I was never very sympathetic with in loco parentis for the university. I thought because we were a large place and there were all kinds of things going on, we had to have certain standards and had to be willing to defend those standards for the good of the university or the good of the individual. But we weren't in place of parents.
What do you think? How do you think Ted Zillman would have answered that?
He would have, I think, been more in loco parentis.
Ted
Zillman, you know, I don't think you ask how Ted Zillman would have felt about loco in loco parentis. I think he thought that the university was even more in loco parentis than parentis were, that when they left home and came to the university, we not only became parents, but we became more, we were required to enforce even more the standards we set than parents might have.
I'm going to ask, this is kind of hard to even question, I don't know if you'll be able to answer it, but it seems as if Ted Zillman more or less represents an older, more traditional approach to like discipline, student discipline, and that I would say that you are bringing about a different way of looking at things. Is that, can I say that, or is that an accurate characterization?
You ask about the difference between Ted Zillman and me. I think Ted Zillman, he was a lawyer, and I think he approached handling the students in a legalistic sense. The law, and you're dealing with the law. I think I approached it as a teacher. And I have been accused by other student personnel workers and people who have taught me, counselors, saying, you're not a counselor, you're a teacher. You know what you want to teach, and you get busy and try to teach it to the students, where a counselor brought up in the Carl Rogers tradition listens to the students and tries to find their feelings and to help them live with that. So I think I was in between the more legalistic over here and the more, not all counselors were permissive, but the counseling approach of you help the student work to it. And I think I was in the middle, a teacher.
Let's move to a couple of other subjects before we get into the 60s here. Discrimination, racial discrimination. Did you witness any racial discrimination at UW, aside from maybe an isolated incident here and there? Were there policies directed that we might now view as discriminatory? And
you ask about discrimination. No, I don't want to say that. The University of Wisconsin has always been a place where people were to be received on their own merit and treated on their own merit. They had to earn what they got. There were not many blacks and on the campus that I became aware of. There were probably more than I knew about. One of my staff members later on worked with black students and said, you know, the interesting thing about these black students here is they're all making it and they're not discriminated against, but most of them had fathers who played on the football team, so they came here in their own rights and they were able to afford. And there were young black women I dealt with who had no money. And we always, in our office, were extra careful to be sure we found support for them. And there were always people in the university, professors we knew, if we were to call and say, I have a student who's got to have a pair of spectacles, and she doesn't have any money, and we don't have any money left in our special fund, and that professor would say, I'll pay for it. So there were people who were in difficulty, but I think when we were aware of them, we knew where to turn. Now, I've spoken here of, you know, the very poor, whether they were black or white. There was another kind of barrier on the campus, and that was to the great number of Jewish students that came to New York. And they from New York and came here in New York State and Chicago, they were either self-isolating or isolated, and they had their own little circles that they moved in, and sometimes there was conflict there. But the university policy was not one of discrimination. It was sort of a tough policy in that we really can't change how other people feel about you, but we can try to say to you, here are some things you can do to maybe make the situation better.
Before we continue, I just want a little bit. Is that causing any kind of problem at all?
Pardon?
Sometimes she's talking, hitting her hand a little bit on the table. Is that any problem here?
I hear it a little, but I haven't noticed it enough to call it a problem.
She were doing it a lot on that.
Yeah, I know. When I'm handling something I'm not sure about, I tend to do that.
I'll just kind of make a signal like
I'll keep my hands in my lap.
No,
I'll keep my feet flat on the floor.
If it would have been real bad, he would have let me know, and I just didn't know how it was being picked up, and I wanted to make sure we weren't losing something we should have here. Interesting things. I went to college in the 60s, and my brothers went in the 50s, and I look at pictures of the two of us, and I see the way they dressed and the way they looked and the way I dressed and the way I looked, and I look at their musical taste and my musical taste in school, and I see there's a real big difference between us, a real generation gap. I'm a week and a day younger than Bill Clinton, so I'm one of the early boomers. You were here at a very, very interesting period of time from about 1956 to about 1967, and you saw that change, that going from the 50s into the 60s. In your estimation, first of all, was there a change? And if there was, if you think there was a change, when did things start to change, and how did you start to notice, when did you start to notice that they were changing?
Change on the college campus that led to the extremities of action, which later developed, you know, to the extremes that we later saw, to me started with World War II. We had, up until that time, had, without question, of course I was in Kansas then, but I think it was true at a lot of schools, and it's still true at some. Regulations on women will live in the dormitories and men will live in dormitories where there aren't women, and there will be closing hours for women, and there will be certain things you will not tolerate, and at Kansas you wouldn't tolerate drinking. Wisconsin had a more liberal policy on that, but there were very rigid undergirdings of among students and among staff about drunkenness and where that led. But then came World War II, and the young men came back after World War II, and they had been in the army, and they had lived as they pleased, and they were living off campus with their wives who were working, and they had babies at home, and no one thought to question what kind of parties they had on Saturday night, as long as they didn't get in trouble with the law. They were grown-up, mature people. And the students, we still had the other students that were teenagers more or less corralled, but around them was all this activity. And by the time I came to Wisconsin in 1956, during the, not 56 as soon as 60s, I would say, some of the children of those GIs started coming back. And I can remember talking with some of them and saying, you know, this, what happened at your house the other night, this just can't be. And they said, well, my father used to tell me these stories about what they did on Saturday night at Wisconsin. And it occurred to me then, if you've brought a generation up that lived in one way, you don't go back the way it was before. And particularly when they have father and mother at home telling stories of their escapades, and they're coming back now, and they're developed a whole different idea of what living on the college campus was about. And I thought it began with the return of the veterans and did not really become apparent till about the 60s. And then the early 60s, John Kennedy came along and inspired them to greater things. I still remember the day when John Kennedy was killed, after he was killed, when we had a memorial for him at the university up on Bascom Hill. And I was standing with the president of the student body, Bill Camel. And he turned with tears in his eyes as we finished it and said, you know, the world will never be the same again. And it was in those years that they lost some of their innocence and some of their respect for the people in the university. And many of us had not changed. We'd grown up in our own, we hadn't grown up as GIs. We'd grown up in the 30s where we were very controlled and where we always did what we were told if we possibly could or figured out a way to get around it without getting in trouble. But we were not too sympathetic with some of those changes, and we didn't understand how serious they were. And yet I think most of us saw the change as maturity, as a sense of responsibility, as really a possibility for the college to become a place that really turned out people who were responsible and who had experienced things, and that there were a lot of things we were asking them to do that were absolutely silly. And yet, it's awfully hard to change a culture. It's awfully hard to change a book of rules that you built up and a book of things that you believe are the right things. But it came with World War II, the aftermath of that, and many of us in student personnel work, the commission I was serving on, was recognizing that there was a change, and what could colleges and universities do to get their staff ready to deal with this new kind of student we were having.
You were dean of students when President Kennedy was assassinated.
I was dean of women.
Dean of women.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you're talking to that one student at the service. What about the women on campus? Did people turn to you? How did that, describe that situation in the immediate aftermath of Kennedy's assassination, how the campus reacted to that?
They were sad. They'd lost a friend. It wouldn't be the same again. And they just went about their business and sort of withdrew, it seemed to me. And then came the protests over Dow and Lyndon Johnson was not a figure they admired. And so they just sort of turned off from that and turned to look at some other things, but they did not turn away from their political interest, it seemed to me. But they hunted other paths.
Did you see it coming? I mean, when the Dow was happening right as you were getting ready to mm-hmm. leave for Barnard, I understand mm-hmm. that, but did you see the not violent, I don't want to use that, but the more agitated form of protest, did you think that was going to happen, or did that surprise you?
It surprised me, in a way.
Start the context.
I was surprised at the protest on the college campus, the violence of it, or the passion, I guess, not violence, the passion of it, how deeply students cared. I knew they cared about a lot of things. I knew they cared about the injustices of race, but mostly that was tied to going down south and protesting. They could overlook something on their own doorstep, but they could go off for a weekend in Mississippi and get in all kinds of difficulties. I knew the depth of their feeling, but I did not know how, I had no idea how it would express itself. And I was as surprised as anyone when it really became violent and became sit-ins and takeover of offices and battling with the police and all of that. I had a belief that students were, if you could get them to listen to you, you could come out at almost at a reasonable compromise in dealing with things. And there was a period, more for me at Columbia and Barnard than here, where you could talk your head off and you couldn't even get to first base unless you conceded all the points. And so often when the people criticize Bill Clinton right now, I say he grew up on a college campus where if you were one of the serious students trying to change minds, you had to compromise. If you were really lucky if you got the people you were fighting to give an inch, and so you learned to work in every way that you could. And a president or a dean had handicaps in that often could not be surmounted. You sent your best faculty, you sent your best student leaders to try to do the talking. But I'd always believed before then that I could sit down with students and talk things out and we could come to a reasonable position. But they were so passionate about it. And many of the causes they were passionate about were good. sometimes they were miserably misinformed, and you couldn't get them to listen. If you said, well, that's not true, well, you're just making it up, you're lying.
Oh, yes, I've heard that before.
Yep.
Interesting. Well, I was there. I was one of the students at the time. I know what you're talking about.
Where were you?
I was at UWM, so mm-hmm. We didn't have that. A couple of people with a sign would have been a major protest UWM. Mm-hmm. Everybody was too busy working. Let's go back for a moment to the men versus women thing on campus. Do you think there was a difference then? In the way women were treated? Did women have to work harder to get things they wanted on campus than men?
I don't think so. Not as long as it was academic and in the classroom.
I need a context on that again.
Well, comparing men and women, in the years I was here at Wisconsin, it always seemed to me that professors were leaned over backwards to help the majority of professors. There were a few who didn't think that a woman should be doing this or that or the next thing, but most of them leaned over backwards and were particularly proud when a woman would do well. I thought there was great academic support for women. We had all kinds of customs and regulations that meant women could not do some of the things that men could do and were, I think, censored more for it. In their dormitories and in their sororities and so on, there were limits on it. But as far as their progress on the campus, young women had every opportunity and were encouraged to do what they could do.
What about the campus leaders like E.B. Fred, Mark Ingram, Fred Harvey Harrington, people like that? What was their attitude toward women and women administrators like yourself?
When I came to the university, E.B. Fred, and this was 56, was concerned that the university should be doing more for women. He was concerned that most women were enrolled in nursing and physical education and home economics, and yet the woman he admired most was Elizabeth McCoy in bacteriology. And he wanted young women to be doing those things. And he talked to me a lot about how to open up other fields for women. And he cared about it. He was baffled about what to do and how to do it. He talked to me about once would it be wise at Wisconsin to put all the programs where there are a majority of women, like occupational therapy and home economics and nursing and women's physical education in one college. And he had in mind that maybe I could be the dean of that college. And I had in mind that the strong women who were heading those programs would take that for about a minute. And anyhow, I wasn't sure it was a very good idea to start out with. This was shortly after I got here. And he would talk about that from time to time, what was being done to encourage women to look beyond just the traditional fields. That's about as far as I think he went. Fred Harrington, on the other hand, was absolutely sure we were in for a new age. He had five daughters, and he had a wife who could speak her own mind, and he was always pushing to do more for women. And I can remember when Kay Clarenbach and Ruth Doyle and Pat Tautfest in the Dean of Women's Office designed a study that they were going to look at faculty wives and people on the faculty who might be potentially candidates for a higher degree or to finish their education. How many women were there? And they designed a questionnaire that was sent out only to the wives of faculty and staff, medical school all across the way, asking what their level of education was. These young women who were doing this thought first that there were women of ability here who weren't having opportunities that they should have. And they thought second that there were women here, if there could be some relaxation of some of the rules in the university, they could go ahead and get PhDs and masters and so on. And so they did this study, and we got the results together, and we did it on our own after hours. we sorted questionnaires. Oh, sure, we used office time to do it. But we sent the questionnaires out, paid for them ourselves, got them back, and correlated them, and found there was a great wealth of talent here that wasn't being used, and found there was a great level of aspiration among some women, that if they just had a couple of hours of a babysitter, or if the School of Education would just relax a couple of their rules, that they could go ahead and get their degrees. I went to Fred Harrington about that and said, do you think you could get any support for this program? And he said, how much have you invested in it on your own? And I told him what we'd invested in it, that we'd found either in our own pockets or some sources we had for money. And he said, well, when you've invested $1,000 of your own time and effort, come back and I'll see if I can get some national support. And the next thing I knew, I was visiting with Florence Anderson at the Carnegie Foundation, and they invested the money that eventually led to the E.B. Fred Scholars out of this study we did on our own. Fred Harrington was totally in favor of it, but he wasn't going to hand us any money until he found out whether we were willing to stick with it. And then he very quickly found the money through the Carnegie Corporation to fund the E.B. Fred Fellows. So he was seriously concerned about it, and just absolutely, I think one of the reasons he made me University Dean of Students, he thought there ought to be a woman in the top administration, and he really cared about it deeply.
Let's talk just for a moment about some of the other, there were some very, very high-powered women on campus for a long time, people like Helen White and Catherine Clarenbach and Elizabeth Brandeis. Could you talk about that group? Were they all in? Did they ever come together? Were there any kind of little associations they formed? Some way that we can define them?
When I think about women at Wisconsin, I always think back to a paper that Catherine Cleary did. It was a paper that said Wisconsin is kind to women. And she went clear back to Belle La Follette and the women in Wisconsin who have been successful. When I came to campus, I was, of course, aware of Helen White. I knew her and admired her from a distance. You always had to distinguish at that time between Helen White of Columbia and Helen White of Wisconsin. Helen White of Columbia was a figure for mathematics teachers. She was a leader in that field. Helen White of Wisconsin was a leader in the total academic realm. The committee that hired me here at Wisconsin, Catherine Cleary chaired it. Ruth Wallerstein was on it. Helen Laird, the mother of Mel Laird, was on it. Oh, Fred Haberman, Carl Steiger, a whole bunch of people who were determined in their interviewing that I would make a stand for women and would support the women of the faculty. Well, and I soon found out after I got here the women of the faculty didn't need my support. They were supporting me, and that was one of E.B. Fred's knacks. After I was hired, I think he must have spent the whole next spring saying, we've hired her, now it's up to you to make her do a good job, because I had more support, more calls, and more offers of help. There was a network that supported you, and they could be men and women as well, the Bunns, Bob and Harriet Bunn. There were just dozens, Helen and Walter Agard, dozens, the Bradleys, who went out of their way to give you support. And I think that's what Helen White and Elizabeth McCoy and all those women had in those years here. The sense that Wisconsin is kind to women and will give them a chance, but you don't need to organize a brigade and start attacking, particularly men. You don't need to do that. You can attack some things that have grown up as customs that are unfair, but you don't make men responsible for it. It was that kind of an attitude that I found.
And I'm sorry.
If you've read Bob Lampman's history of the economics department, you know Elizabeth Brandeis didn't have smooth going all the time, but I don't think she was ever put down by it, and I think when she spoke her mind, she was respected. So
I have to ask you one final question. And you mentioned Helen C. White, who was one of my favorite people who mm-hmm. studied on many occasions. And she was known amongst the students often as the woman in purple.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just tell about how that came about? And do you know why she? I know she dressed in purple, but do you know why?
I think she liked it.
Context.
Helen White dressed in purple because she liked the color. She loved hats that had flowers on them, and a woman down on State Street made her hats, and she loved to wear those. I know one funny story, which I think is not inappropriate to tell. When Lillian Gilbreth came here one term, you know, cheaper by the dozen, Lillian Gilbreth, the expert in engineering, came here and visited one term and taught in the engineering school. And Helen White was on leave, and Lillian Gilbreth lived in Helen White's apartment. One day she came to the Dean of Women's office and said, you know, could I just borrow some white sheets from the dormitory? I really can't stand to sleep on purple sheets and pillowcases every night. So we found some white sheets and sent them over. But I think Helen White liked purple. She had purple sheets. I know that from Lillian Gilbreth. She wore purple. And I think also Helen White was not above, not in a bad way, but was not above furthering a concept that might make her stronger as chairman of the English department or stronger when she spoke in a meeting. No one challenged Helen White, and I think she cultivated that image, and I think wearing purple may have been a part of it. You knew who Helen White was and what she stood for. And she was one of the ones who early on told me the university is a fine place for students, but they've got to have someone who can cut the red tape. It's all here for them, but they've got to have someone who can cut the red tape. And that's what your job is. You're to cut the red tape so they can do the things that they want to do that are right. And if you can't do it yourself, you've got to get to know the people in the university and the dean's offices and all around who can cut the red tape and get the nonsense out of the way.
Which is what you spent a good part of your years here doing.
Yeah,
exactly.
And
just for a personal note here, I asked different people about Helen C. White and why she wore purple, and the best story I've gotten is that there was a rumor that she'd lost her love in lilac time. That was...
I think that'd be the last reason she'd wear purple.
But the reason, I finally found it one day in the Daily Cardinal. A Daily Cardinal reporter asked her, now I think this she would be giving an honest mm-hmm. answer. She said the reason she wears purple is because she travels a lot and she doesn't like to pay a lot of attention to clothing, and purple goes with anything.
Yeah,
purple goes
it does.
With just about anything. So mm-hmm. she said, I wear purple simply as a matter of convenience. She likes the color purple, but mainly it's because of... It's an easy color for her to deal with. And
Helen White did things in her department and all through the university that simplified things. She didn't like to spend hours in meeting, you know, discussing trivia. She could very quickly get she wanted things to move ahead quickly, and she could very well wear purple. I can remember her hats, and she just twice a year went down and had this lady make her hats, and she didn't. I suppose if they went with purple, why, that's fine.
Ralph, I think we're just about done down here. How does it sound to you? I thought that was great. We ended on, and look at this. I have a purple paperclip here that I just happened to pick from my pile today. So, that was.